It's Depression Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. In March of this year, I got my first COVID vaccine. I did the Pfizer, the PFIZ, the Pfizdog. I got it after almost exactly a year of isolation, precaution, distance, masking, and otherwise changing everything about how I'd been living. The first dose meant I could still catch COVID, but I wouldn't die from it, which is something I'd been afraid of for a year. Then exactly 3 weeks later, I got the second dose and I was on my way to being, and I put a question mark at the end here, safe? But the two shots in the arm won't make everything else that happened go away. There's no cure for that. We have spent much of the year in mortal fear. A tiny, tiny clump of cells invisible to the naked eye has been out there, easily breathed in, and then you might die. And someone you love might die, just as well over 500,000 people did. We've all been changed by this, forever. And the word I keep thinking of for what we've all been through is trauma. Trauma is something that doesn't go away once the inciting event has passed. It stays, and it creates problems. It's the gift that keeps on taking. Are we, as a collective society, traumatized? I reached out to my friend Dr. Ken Duckworth. He's the medical director for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And we started with a definition.
Trauma is a psychological experience which many people find overwhelming or a direct threat to their safety. So if you look at trauma, you find that people hyper-experience the experience, they feel numb to the experience, or they feel closed off. Undigested movies, if you will, of the trauma. A good example of that would be flashbacks or nightmares. So these are things that are so emotionally loaded, they can't be integrated into one's memory. So it's an overwhelming experience. So combat is a classic example. Rape is a classic example. And a life-threatening, profoundly overwhelming experience. So people with trauma tend to have a physiologic response. One of my teachers was Bessel van der Kolk, and he wrote a book called The Body Keeps the Score. Yes. And the idea is, as you can't integrate it into your brain mapping systems, your body remembers. And so people frequently have a very strong startle response. So, you know, you'll see, you know, a helicopter go by and one person will jump at a party. Well, that person may have had a trauma history in the service, right? A different person might respond differently to a different stimuli. So some trauma is specific, but I think the idea that there's physical, emotional, the psychological dimensions to trauma is well established. It's important to recognize that trauma is now really considered part of the mental health portfolio. We've been through periods of time in mental health. Oh, trauma is not important. What's important is the brain, right? Trauma doesn't really matter. It's mostly imagined. Now I think we're fully on board that trauma has to be considered in every aspect of care, whether it's crisis response, hospitalization, how you prepare an office. A person might be traumatized by something that you've produced in your hospital or police response or office. And the idea is you be sensitive to that and be mindful of it. So I think we've made a lot of progress, John, on psychological trauma. But as I'm discussing this, this is mostly considered acute trauma, right? You're in a plane crash, right? And you're acutely traumatized. And I have a feeling you're going to ask me a little bit about the pandemic, because that's more of a chronic trauma for most of us.
That's the line I kind of wanted to draw and figure out where it was. Because I look at what's happening this past year, deaths and fear and massive disruption of society. And I think if this was happening to one person, I could say, yes, that person lost people close to them. Their safety was in danger. They were scared to go outside. Can we extrapolate that out to an entire society and say we are all under trauma?
I think small t can be generalized. That is to say disruption, upset, Some people have found this overwhelming. Some people have lost people and can't be at their side. For those people, this is likely capital T trauma. Mm-hmm. But for many people whose lives have been disrupted, whose jobs have been changed, whose relationships have been altered, you know, I think of relationships as mild antidepressants and mild anti-anxiety interventions. And so, you know, we've lost in losing so many of our in-person connections, some of these things. I do like to say side effects. Some relationship may cause conflict about loading the dishwasher, right? So, you know, if it has anti-anxiety and antidepressant qualities, relationship, you know, the side effects are mild of loving relationships, if at all. All kidding aside. And I think that we've lost that in this. And for some people who have a pre-existing vulnerability, that is more traumatic. For some people who lived with panic disorder or prior depression or bipolar disorder, that may be harder on them. So it's very individual. The people who have lost their jobs, the people who've lost loved ones, I would likely report this as capital T trauma. And one of the other things about the person dimension of this in a larger population is prior history of trauma typically informs current trauma. John, you know about the adverse childhood experience study. People who've been traumatized in youth, and this is a retrospective work of genius, tend to have more mental health and medical vulnerabilities later in life. Mm-hmm. So is it something that the body remembers, per Dr. Vanderkolk? Is it something that changes your risk-reward interaction? Like, what is the change? But if you have more traumatic experiences younger in life, you're more vulnerable to medical, mental health, and substance vulnerabilities later. And of course, trauma.
So then if somebody has gone through previous trauma, if they've gone through a major depressive disorder, some other sort of mental disorder that they had, are you saying that this has been hitting them harder than it would somebody who's just had a blessed and easy life, just happily walking along?
In many cases, prior experiences of trauma are reactivated by traumatic adversity.
Because there's similarity? Because those people are being reminded of the what had gone wrong before?
Maybe psychological. It may also be physiological, right? Mm. So the person who was in a plane crash may have a sympathetic nervous system, which is more quickly activated. They will startle, right, more quickly than the next person. Okay. Put that person in isolation for a year, cut them off from their friends. They learn they're laid off from their job. They lose a parent. They can't be there for their parent to COVID. And, you know, I think you have the formulation of a person who has a prior trauma vulnerability and has been capital T re-traumatized in many cases.
Hmm. I was trying to think of something to compare COVID to. As an event that a huge swath of society is going through in an upsetting way. But I came up with civic unrest and a political crisis. But then I realized we've also had those in the last year as well. Like there's been rioting in the streets. There's people storming the Capitol. There's, you know, horrible speech coming out of a campaign. There's been a dehumanizing as well. Is it instructive to look at all these things as potential triggering events, potential traumatic events that are worsening to people who might have already experienced something like that?
So if you're an African-American person who's been mistreated by a police officer, it is likely, based on what I've learned from people in that experience, it's not my experience, you know, that's re-triggering for people. Some people find it re-triggering to have to explain it to people who didn't have that experience.
Right.
So it's a very individual construct. A comparison that I've thought of, John, is the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
I have some gray hair. And so my parents grew up in the Depression. And my mother grew up without running water. And I asked her how Thanksgiving worked. And she said, well, we ate eggs three meals a day from our 10 chickens. On Thanksgiving, one of us would go out and strangle a chicken, and we would cook the chicken for Thanksgiving. My father dropped out of high school to support the family. My parents, 45 years later, are raising me. Mm. And before we go visit our grandmother, they say, there's a gallon of milk in the refrigerator, Kenny. We're going to leave in 2 hours, but you need to drink all of that before we went because we paid 17 cents on that. Now, I happened to be a 15-year-old strapping lad. And sooner or later, I was going to consume an ungodly amount of food that day. I mean, I'm sure they were on the edge of, are you kidding me? But I did drink the whole gallon of milk. And to me, that's a 40 to 50-year impact of a psychological experience.
Yeah.
My brother was a very successful real estate developer. And my parents used to say to him, you know, it may not always be this good. Everything he did was successful. Every development was a grand slam home run. He was a genius. In the housing collapse of 2007, Joe said to me, you know, Mom and Dad might have been right about that whole, it's not always a straight line up. So even as they had been, I would say, capital T traumatized by the depression, they were able to impart lessons to people.
Yeah, I was speaking with Kelsey Dara, who was on our show, and we were trying to figure out if we would be a flapper response. You know, after the Spanish flu pandemic came the roaring 20s.
Yeah.
Or would we be like Kelsey's grandfather, who she said still hoarded pizza crusts and just froze them in case he needed bread later on because he had been through the Great Depression? Like what is going to be... Is this generation, especially of young adults, I think, being formed right now, are they just going to be a notable population that is just going to behave anomalously forever?
Well, I think it's important to be humble. We don't know, right? We have a lot to learn. This is a generation that's going to really appreciate school. And when their children don't want to go to school, I think they're going to get a fair amount of music.
Yes.
You know, I wasn't allowed to go to senior prom or junior prom or be the lead in the class play or set the record for rebounds as I had planned to do. You're going to school. So that's one possible outcome, right? An appreciation for the role of education in a classroom is one possibility. Some people may feel, you know, by missing these developmental milestones that they've really lost something, and that will stay with some people. Younger generation is better talking about mental health than my generation, your generation, John. Yep. And that's really to be saluted.
Let's say all the vaccines are administered today. COVID-19 wiped off the face of the earth. What stays with the, like, I like to think everybody would high five and dance in the streets and then return to the bars and restaurants and there'd be concerts every night and everybody would be fine. What stays with us coming out of this? What should we be prepared to keep housing within our minds for a while?
And what we may be unable to shake, right?
Yeah.
So some of this isn't all conscious. So first of all, if you ended COVID today with all the vaccines, we should work a lot on our Nobel Prize portfolio because respect for science is in some question in our society.
Yeah.
This is a virus. The mRNA science had been 20 years in the making of your tax dollars, and it's returned something that's life-saving. But there are other ways to do it. So the first is a profound respect for science, right? I would say, which it's been painful for me as a physician to see wanton disregard for science by many people with a voice. That's the first thing. The second thing is, I think a lot of people will be anxious to return to life as it was. Remember, we're pretty well wired, John, to be mindful of mastodons that could easily eat us and ruin our day. So when you have something really good happen to you and something really bad happen to you in a day, it's common for people to stay with the thing that was hard or perceived failure or humiliation, as opposed to the fact that you did something really great or something went well for you. I think that's wired into our sympathetic nervous system. Pay attention to the stressful, anxiety-provoking thing that will keep you alive. Now, the thing isn't a mastodon. It's a microscopic collection of DNA that is kind of alive and kind of dead and incredibly scary, right? Because you don't know how it's going to hit you, and you don't know if it's going to hit somebody you love, and you don't know if it's going to kill somebody you love or you. So the fear process in a person is real. It's important to recognize that. It's normal to be afraid and anxious. How soon you can take the foot off the brake is going to be different for different people, right? Risk takers are already taking risks right now, right? They are going to events right now, becoming part of super spreader events. You know, that's happening right now. I have a feeling they're going to have less anxiety per square inch going back to life. People who have learned that working from home works for them. They're introverts. They secretly never liked business meetings. In fact, they hate corporate events, right? I think there's a psychological response for them. I know seniors in high school, I don't know a person that isn't longing to go to college and to have a semblance of a normal experience. And I think there'll be a lot of momentum for that. So I think it's going to get down to the details, right? Does one of the variations on the virus resist the vaccine? Is there reason for us to be cautious yet engaged? Or is it simply the psychological process of, okay, the warning's over? I don't think people are a light switch, right? When you've been traumatized, isolated, you have a vulnerability. My experience is it stays with people.
More with Dr. Ken Duckworth in a moment. By the way, his chair squeaks. You know what I like? I like when things are easy. Man, easy things are just the best, because obviously there are plenty of parts of life already that can be very, very difficult. So bring on the easy. My favorite easy things, I have to admit, are when something seems like it would be difficult, but turns out to be easy. Oh, I love that. Case in point, building your own website and web presence with Squarespace. I did this years ago and found it to be delightfully simple. I can build a site, make changes, redesign everything if I want, all very simple. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. You don't need to be a web guru. You become the guru. Start a completely personalized website with the new guided design system, Squarespace Blueprint. You can choose from professionally curated layout and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, tailored to your brand or business and optimized for every device. Make checkout seamless for your customers with simple but powerful payment tools. They accept credit cards, PayPal, and Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and Clearpay. Upload video content, organize your video library, and showcase your content on beautiful video pages. You can even sell access to your video library by adding a paywall to your content. So why not get started now? Go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/depresh to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. squarespace.com/depresh.
Stipulating that everybody has a different response and, you know, mental health never plays out the same way for any two people, isn't it logical that there's going to be a jumpiness long after we know that you're vaccinated? Like, you won't catch the virus, but you're still going to be jumpy forevermore and like scared to talk to people up close and telling your kids not to breathe on other people because you never know. Is that going to still be with us?
I think your mileage may vary. I think some people will feel that way. So I'm vaccinated. I'm a physician. I'm volunteering, giving shots next week. Great. Right? So how fun is that to be able to get engaged in this? But I still wear a mask. Do I think it's a little silly, because I'm actually vaccinated now.
Yeah.
I would appear to be a very low risk lad. But it turns out I'm still a little anxious. I want to see that it's okay. I'm wearing a mask. I'm like, well, if I forget the mask, I go back and get the mask. I still do that, even though I'm vaccinated. So I think psychologically, when I watch a movie, John, and I see people in a bar talking, I'm like, hey, they're not wearing masks, right? So psychologically, something's going on with me, right? That I've integrated this idea of a protective shield around my face and around my psyche in some ways from this unknown terror. So everybody's going to be different in this regard. And I think the idea is to be gentle with yourself. If you feel, you know, this is going to take a while, that's okay. If this is going to be reactivating for you, know that. you might want to seek help to figure that out, whether it's cognitive processing therapy, EMDR. Heavy aerobic exercise downregulates the physiology part of trauma, right? Check with your doctor before you do heavy aerobic exercise.
So this wave of people in a mental health crisis coming out of COVID, what are they reporting? What are they complaining of? And what's the crisis in terms of a diagnosis that is the most common?
Center for Disease Control did a very elegant study in August of 2020. So it's not brand new. Here we are talking in March of 21. But it was a real-time biopsy of thousands of people who online took the standardized test that you might take in your primary care office or I might take. The PHQ-9 for depression, the GAD-7 for anxiety, a trauma scale. They asked people, how are you doing? And what they found is just under 42% of people had clinically significant mental health symptoms. 42%. So Vietnamese say 1 in 5. We're talking over 2 in 5 now. Now, that was from the last week of June. It's unimaginable that it's better. It's unimaginable that it's better.
Right.
So more people have died. More people have lost their jobs. More uncertainty. So I think that anxiety, depression, trauma, and relapse were the big four in that order.
What do you mean relapse?
If you have a substance use disorder, vulnerability.
Oh, okay.
People are picking up alcohol, they're returning back to the vulnerability. Again, if you think of them for some people as a self-medication construct, right? Your mental health is in good shape and you have good supports in place. You don't need to use. Put the people in isolation. Some people don't like online AA or NA. Some people under that pressure have a recurrence of cravings or anxiety and depression, right? Because of course, co-occurring disorders are common in this line of work. But anxiety was number one, depression was number two, trauma, which you mentioned earlier, was number three. 26% of people reported traumatic feelings or experiences rooted in trauma, and 13% of people reported relapse or increased consumption of substances. So let's say you get to 42%. It's also interesting, John, back to your earlier point, it wasn't across the board. Young people, very high numbers. 18 to 24. They didn't do kids. They did adults. Very high numbers. High numbers of distress, high numbers of suicidal thoughts in the last 30 days. And I look at this as a child psychiatrist through the developmental lens. I'm supposed to be watching Netflix. I have a couple of gray hair. I'm supposed to be home hanging out, right?
Right.
I've already gone through some developmental stages where I've hobbled together some love, some friendships, or a career. You know, it is what it is. But, you know, you look at somebody who's 18 years old, they haven't figured out their identity. Can they love someone? Who are they? Are they lovable? What are they going to be? Where's their place on this earth? It's zero surprise to me at all that that population's been hit harder. People of color, essential workers, and unpaid caregivers, John, had very high measures of distress. So now you're at home caring for someone who's ill, vulnerable. Didn't say what kind, and you lack your ability to walk out the door and spend time with somebody you care about in person over a coffee or a beer or a substance of your choice, right? And so the sharing human piece. So for some people, again, this isolation, you lose the antidepressant effect of human connection.
What should we keep in mind coming out of this as people with brains, as people with heads and minds, to make sure that we're kind of on track and living our mentally healthiest life? And what should we keep in mind for those around us, for our loved ones, for our kids, for our parents?
Well, thank you for asking me an easy question, John.
Yeah. What's the best self-care that we can administer in an evaluative sense?
A cognitive framework of compassion. If you didn't learn how to speak Spanish or become an organic gardener during this year of, you know, terrible things, that's okay. If you've battled a little bit with a mental health vulnerability that's familiar to you and you thought you had it under control, be compassionate to yourself. A lot of people are feeling this. NAMI's one of our big expressions is you are not alone. That was really never truer than in the pandemic. You are not alone. And just remember that. That's a cognitive piece. Now, if you're having trouble functioning in school, as a parent, on your Zoom calls, right? All these things, if functioning is a problem and it's gone on for a while, 2 weeks for depression, 1 day for panic disorder. If you have a second panic disorder, right, you have a panic attack. The second panic attack is panic disorder. Duration, you know, is more than a day. Functional limitations plus symptoms of emotions, thoughts, behavior that are in the mental health space, I'd consider trying to get an evaluation. This is another challenge we face, John. It takes 8 months to make a mental health wave, and it takes 8 years to make a social worker. So we're having a supply-demand mismatch that has gotten quite intense. And it's really important to recognize that you have to, like a vaccine, you have to find a way to get in line. It's get on somebody's wait list, get on somebody else's wait list, beat up your health plan, have them do what they're supposed to do because you're writing them a check every month for your health care. There's this whole concept of out-of-network mental health practitioners. But also do things that you've done while you're waiting. For some people, online support helps. NAMI support groups help. AA can help. So I don't think that, you know, the end all and the be all is to get a mental health evaluation, but they have tools that can help you. But my major message is compassion, lowered expectations. If you felt that your kid didn't learn much this year, again, you are not alone. Your kid is bright, and that's going to have a cohort effect more than it's going to have an effect on your child.
I can confidently say that your kid did not learn much this year in what was called school. So don't worry about that at all.
That's right.
I've started several writing projects. So in terms of starting projects, I've done great. Finishing, not so much.
Well, good. So, you know, this is, again, you know, just a one of a kind.
Yeah, it's really...
In our lifetime. When I tell people, say, what should I do for my mental health? I say, hey, this is my first pandemic too.
Yeah.
You know, I've been to the American Psychiatric Association meetings for 25 years. I've been to zero pandemic mental health classes.
Jeez.
And this year in May, I'll go to a dozen of them virtually because we're learning as we go. So a lot of this is about resilience and creativity.
What are some red flags that you should be aware of for yourself or others, specifically in regard to trauma, specifically in regard to maybe there's some PTSD coming out of the trauma that you suffered during the pandemic?
Well, let's start with the basics of functioning. If you can't function in your roles, that's one ballpark. If you're battling to function, that's another. Concerns about your safety, thoughts about harming yourself, killing yourself or someone else, that's reason to get an evaluation. With trauma, right, if you're beset with nightmares, there are treatments for that. There are actual treatments for that. If you're beset with flashbacks, nightmares, a startle response, feeling cut off, probably one of the psychotherapies that has been proven to be helpful, EMDR, cognitive processing therapy, exposure therapy for some people, may be of use. And so, again, that you were traumatized, you know, I always like the question, what happened to you, instead of what's wrong with you.
That's Dr. Ken Duckworth, Medical Director for the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Lots of good insight and information available at NAMI.org, NAMI.org.
Mr. Ripperman, what are you doing?
I'm just taking one last look. My co-workers.
Every journey comes to an end.
Remember, Plek, the space will be with you always.
Sorry, who are you again?
Master Kieran.
Oh, right. Sorry.
Just calling in.
Friendships will be tested.
Dar, you have to do it. You have to shoot Plek.
Okay.
You shot him so fast.
Destinies will be fulfilled.
I've become a complete bird. I'm flying.
On April 28th, the saga starts concluding.
Guys, we don't have a choice. We have to put on a show.
We can do it in the old barn. We've got the costumes. We've got a stage. We can do it, you guys.
Mission to Zix, the final season on Maximum Fun.
Max Fun Drive's almost here. It starts on Monday, May 3rd, ends on May 14th, and it's the best time to support the shows you love. Here are some folks like you sharing what Max Fun and our shows mean to them.
Most importantly, it's meant community.
And yeah, just thanks for hanging out, making joke 'em ups, and making my week a little bit brighter.
So, thanks, Max Fun, for making me a better person and making sure that I'm surrounded by better people.
Thanks again for all you do. Love supporting Max Fun, and keep it up.
Come back Monday, May 3rd for more details from your favorite hosts. We'll have some of the best episodes of the year, special Max Fun Drive thank you gifts, and maybe a few surprises. That's Monday, May 3rd. Until then.
So we got a great overview from Ken. We got the view from 30,000 feet. But what do the effects of the stress of COVID look like on the ground, in the trenches? Dr. Kasera Dayet is a licensed clinical psychologist in Massachusetts. She works directly with children and adults on many issues, including trauma.
Just from a very basic perspective, the number one complaint that many folks I see have talked about is issues with productivity. So, you know, their relationship to being productive and how to understand that as they've been maybe stuck at home, having a lot expected of them, working under unusual circumstances. They've really struggled with feeling a lot of shame around not getting the same amount of work done that they normally would. So that's like just across the board. And for the college students I see, they've been struggling with their school experience being interrupted and not being able to keep up with their schoolwork in the same way because of the situation. Yeah.
When you say productive, is that in terms of people's jobs or just in terms of people's overall lives?
Both, for sure. So like folks have fallen behind on exercise routines that they would normally do, maybe writing. For many of my folks who are creative and love doing music, a lot of their creative outlets they feel like has suffered, but also they feel like what they're producing in a work day isn't the same. So I've had to walk people through just that 8-hour workday has not been realistic for a lot of folks, depending on what job you're in. There are some where companies have placed more burden on people because they are at home. So they're expecting them to produce more than they would have when they weren't in the office. But then for other people who have more flexibility, without that sort of schedule and being around colleagues, they found it hard to be able to get that sort of 8-hour workday in that they normally would.
And what do you think is the root of that? Because it couldn't just be millions of people developing ADHD where none existed before. Is there depression at the root of that? Is there an anxiety disorder deep in there?
Yeah, I mean, it would be hard to say without knowing somebody specifically if it's an anxiety disorder or depression. But for the folks that I see, there has been a lot of anxiety. There has been a lot of fear. There has been a lot of depression. But it's also just realizing that society has expected certain things of them and continued to expect those things of them, at least at the start of the pandemic to like the middle of the pandemic. And they didn't know how to deal with those expectations not changing while everything about their lives did, right? Mm. And things started feeling even more out of control. And that feeling of lack of control and not knowing how to deal with this really, you know, ramped up people's fears, ramped up people's feelings of hopelessness and interrupted folks' sleep and things like that.
So when we think about the term trauma, it's often applied to a upsetting event. There's, you know, an incident of violence where you feel unsafe or you're in mortal fear. It's a car crash. It's something like that that causes damage, that causes enough upset that you can't really process it in the moment. It gets shoved away. It creates problems later. Do you think that what's happening in a lot of the people you see is genuine trauma?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I would say that without any, you know, worry about pushback. You know, a lot of folks have used the term collective trauma to discuss what's going on in the pandemic, to describe what we've been going through, global trauma. And historically, we know that global trauma is, you know, any majorly upsetting, disruptive event for large groups of people in an entire society. And from history, our collective traumas that we have to speak to in the United States is the Great Depression, World War II, and the Holocaust across the board, the Great Recession, September 11th, and less commonly mentioned, of course, 400 years of slavery, right, for folks of color, for African Americans. And so all of those things are collective trauma. And those things have ways of disrupting our entire way of being in society, but also as individuals, that is very much parallels trauma responses.
So if we're seeing collective trauma, if we're seeing individual trauma, we're coming up in a point where we're going to be vaccinated. Like by summer, people who want to get vaccine can get the vaccine, and we'll reach that 80% or whatever it is herd immunity threshold. What happens then? Like, we don't magically get over all that we've been through with COVID, with, you know, with watching all these people die, watching all these problems emerge. What are we like after?
I think that's the question, right? That is on many folks' mind. And from what, at least we can't predict what's going to happen. But from what we do know about trauma, a lot of people have been stuck in sort of a stasis, so to speak, unable to process. And in the field of psychology, we have this saying that when you're working with trauma, we're hoping that the person is out of the thing before we start processing the thing.
Out of the immediate danger.
Right, exactly. And for our nurses and doctors, for example, or therapists like myself, we're still in immediate danger. Everyone's still in immediate danger, right? And that processing has been put on hold. There's a lot of ungrieved grief. And what I'm particularly worried about is the crash that is going to happen for a lot of people once that sort of heightened sense of danger starts to dissipate. And for some people, this could show up in the form of major illnesses. Like, that sustained trauma can actually keep your body in a heightened state of cortisol elevation with our stress hormones. And we're not meant to live like that. Our bodies are not meant to live under those circumstances. And so I'm particularly worried about what kinds of illnesses and things are going to show up alongside the already existing depression and anxiety that people are experiencing.
I mean, I always think of car accidents that I've been in, and when the immediate thing is happening, and I've been unfortunate enough to be in like two or three of these things, there's almost a sense of calm of like, oh, okay, here's what I need to do immediately now. I need to get out of the car at this point because, and I think it's just this rush of, I don't know if it's adrenaline or cortisol, like you said, that's telling me what to do in the moment. And then later on, I'll collapse and I'll freak out about what had happened. And I just wonder if we're all in that moment of calm as the car wreck is happening right now, and the real trouble to pay will be later down the line.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're astutely speaking to our fight, flight, freeze response, right? That when we are in dangerous situations, we have different mechanisms that mobilize for our body to cope. And in some ways, some of us, many of us have been forced into freeze. We can't really do anything. And as we know, some folks have fought that, right? They've gone outside anyway. They've been doing things anyway, right? Even though, you know, they really shouldn't be. But some of us have frozen. We've frozen and, we've become numb as we're watching this happen. And we don't have any control over our sort of exit response. And so, again, we have this prolonged, we haven't been able to exit. Our typical body's response to situations like this hasn't been able to mobilize. And we're just waiting for what's going to happen next.
So after this all spreads and after we have that collapse, you talked about the physical health effects. Mm-hmm. What can we expect from people's mental health going forward?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to say that I work very hard along with other therapists, clinicians, to talk about the fact that mental health is health care. And so I don't see physical illness is separate from that mental health component, right? Because for many people, their mental health, they experience all of those symptoms in their body. And they're not necessarily having all of the thoughts that somebody else might have, all of the ruminations, all of the identifiable cognitive things that we would look for. They're feeling it all up in their bodies, right? So I think that that illness piece is very much as much a part of the mental health and shouldn't be discounted. But to speak to some of your, you know, other things that you're talking about, you know, for many people, substance use has become a big issue. You know, maybe they struggled before, but they've been self-medicating even more to cope. I've had almost twice as many evaluations of teenagers who are using substances as I did before the pandemic, and pretty rough stuff. There's also identity issues. People have been trying to figure out, what does this mean for my life? Where do I go next? People who normally that I would see who would want to be like, I want to be as far away from my family as possible, are now like, let me figure out how to, I can be as close to my family as possible. Right. And so there's some mourning. And then the biggest one that I'm concerned about is an increase in sort of death anxiety. So, you know, death anxiety is sort of normal fears that people have about death and illness and dying. Right. And before the pandemic, what we would consider abnormal, I put that in air quotes for those who can't see me, is now what is normal. Right. It's normal to worry about people getting sick. It's normal to worry about yourself getting sick. It's normal to worry about your loved ones dying. What's going to happen when we're sort of in a relaxed state, and maybe that's not as pressing? I think people are still going to be worried about that. And is that going to paralyze them as they're trying to readjust to their lives? I think people are also maybe going to either try to go all in on social activity and overwhelm themselves, or find themselves avoiding because they're so anxious about some of the same things that we've had to worry about. Is this still safe? How do I readjust? And I saw, I don't know how much you like watch parodies and memes, but I've seen a lot of these great videos about people talking about post-pandemic dating.
Uh-huh.
Have you seen any of these?
No, I can only imagine.
I mean, they're funny, but they're sort of, they're funny because they're on the nose, right? Like people are worrying, how close do I sit to someone? Right. Do I touch you? Do I ask for a hug? So I think there's going to be a lot of worries about, you know, in our mental health, the impacts of readjusting to social contact. And then on the more extreme end, especially for our first responders, nightmares, flashbacks, you know, I think we're definitely going to be seeing a lot of active PTSD symptoms.
So what should someone keep in mind as we're heading into this new world? What do you tell individuals in terms of advice for being as prepared as possible?
I think it connects back to some of the things that I'm saying, right? Is that I think the best way to put this is being mindful of your energy, right? We've all been working with different levels of energy. And I think for some of us, it's going to be really tempting to just throw ourselves back into social engagements because it feels safer and overwhelm ourselves, right?
Yeah. We're not in shape for that yet.
Exactly. Exactly. And we might not be prepared for other people's anxiety, right? And managing, interacting with that. And so I do strongly suggest people sort of being intentional about spacing out their social contacts a little bit so that they can check in with themselves in between to see how they're doing. And for people who are worried about spending time with people, being intentional about scheduling some social contacts so they can sort of get used to that. I think workplaces are really going to have to be vigilant about employees struggling to return to normal work schedules. And you know, I know some places are doing still planning to do hybrid, but if they aren't and everybody's been staying at home, you know, I would highly recommend that they be thoughtful about how they reintegrate everyone back into the workspace, because I think it's going to be hard for people. I think it's going to be really hard for people. And I know we want to get back to it. And it's still going to be hard. Like both of those things can be true at the same time.
The pandemic was already going on, was already in full swing when George Floyd was murdered. how did these two situations affect each other, inform each other in, you know, kind of a, in the double crisis that was going on, according to people that you've seen?
I mean, I see a lot of people of color. I see a lot of immigrants. So I see a lot of folks in the Black community, and racial reckoning and racial trauma layered on top of COVID trauma really paralyzed a lot of the people that I see. And I'm also perfectly fine to admit, including myself.
Sure.
Like, it was a lot of how do we handle this on top of everything else that's already happening to everyone?
When you say paralyzed, what does that paralysis look like?
You know, not being able to think clearly, you know, especially for people of color, racial trauma makes it hard to think with any sort of clarity about what's happening in your life. We may also gaslight ourselves, right? That internalized part of racism where we're like, well, should I be this upset? Should I be feeling this way? People didn't know how to respond to what white friends were feeling, you know, sort of saying this is so horrible and things like that.
White friends looking to their Black friends to contextualize everything and maybe reassure them.
Exactly, exactly. And yeah. And crying a lot to them, right? Or not knowing how to check in. Like, I was teaching people, how do you check in with your Black friends? Along with the anxiety about getting sick and dying, there was a lot of anxiety about getting killed, right? And just carrying around the losses of Black people just piling up and piling up and piling up in your psyche adds to another sense of lack of integrity of your body. Like, you don't know what's going to happen to your body. It doesn't belong to you. And not only that, but some unknown virus can kill you at any minute too.
Yeah. The dread of fearing for your life already, and then here comes an invisible virus, and mm-hmm. you have to fear the very air itself.
Right. Exactly.
What does it look like then for people in the African American community coming out of COVID when this event, the killing of George Floyd, has cut even deeper over the course of the time that the pandemic was there? Like, is there more depression? Is that depression likely to linger, to turn into something else? Like, what are you concerned about as a therapist?
So just for people listening, I am a Black therapist. I'm not African American. I'm actually an immigrant. So I think that's important to say, but I work with many folks in the African American community. And I say that because our experience of the African diaspora is very different. But at the same time, I'm not seen as Black West Indian by white people in this country, right? Mm. I'm Black. You're and Black. That's it.
Yeah.
So I have certain shared experiences, even though my ancestry history is not the same. And the biggest thing, and this was true of with September 11th too, was that increased racial discrimination and damaged national pride, which is occurring across the spectrum for lots of folks, whether or not they're Black or brown, right? But I think, you know, there's definitely a sense of, is society going to protect me? Like, I already knew it wasn't really on my side. And now I really know it's not on my side. Like, that's what it's been feeling like for people. You know, it's one thing to know it in your bones and it's not super conscious. It's another thing to have it in your face every single day on the news, on social media. And so I'm expecting, as I've already started to see, that people are not going to know how to relate to themselves with this. You know, I've had folks say, like, it's so, I just wish I didn't have to be Black right now. This is so exhausting. It's so exhausting. And I know, I like, it's hard, right? Like, I don't want to not be Black, but also it is exhausting.
That's Dr. Kasera Diet. She says her calendar has been full since last May. No room for new patients. Does not even have any other therapists to refer people to. Everybody she knows is full as well. Dr. Diet does have some online resources to recommend, and we have those links over at our site, MaximumFun.org/depressionmode. Next time on Depression Mode, he lost his marriage, his children stopped speaking to him, he was staring into the abyss, and hosting a popular comedy show every week. And he got through it.
What I could eventually figure out is that if I could get through each day, then tomorrow I could see what happened. If you cannot see any end to the darkness, then don't think about that. Don't think about how this is all going to end. Just get through the day. Just get through the day.
Peter Sagal of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me talks desperation and rebirth. We love it when you recommend Depression Mode to friends. It might help them. Also, something that matters a lot, hit subscribe, download those episodes, give us 5 stars, write reviews. All of that helps more people find out about the show, which helps our mission of getting those conversations happening. Depression Mode is your show too. You're on the team. Let us know who you want me to interview, what issues you want to hear about. We want your requests. You can email us. Our electric mail address is depressionmode@maximumfun.org. Speaking of requests and keeping in touch, the Max Fund Drive is coming up in just 1 week. It is your chance to make membership on the Depression Mode team official. It's a way to celebrate Mental Health Awareness Month, and it's a way to guarantee that Depression Mode stays strong and ready for you and for people you know. And also, we have cool thank you gifts. May 3rd, that starts. May the 3rd be with you for the Max Fun Drive. We're on Twitter and Instagram at DepreshPod. Our Depression Mode newsletter is available on Substack. Search that up. I'm on Twitter at John Moe, all one word, same on Instagram. Depression Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. Our theme song, Building Wings, is written and recorded by Rhett Miller, aka the Serial Lady Killer.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now. Building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out. Building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason. Maybe there's no reason. I just keep believing. No one knows the answer. Maybe there's no answer. I just keep on dancing.
Hey, this is Hannah from Minneapolis, and I promise you're not the only one who feels this way.
If you need it, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's free. It's at 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-TALK. That number is also available immediately if you Google the word suicide. Thank you, Google, for that. To reach the crisis text line, text the word HOME to 740-740. I'm so glad you were here to listen to the show. Depression Mode is a production of Maximum Fun. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.